Tonight, we're going to pick back up with our study of Elijah, and the story that we're going to begin tonight is probably the most familiar story, the most familiar lesson that's given concerning Elijah. As we go through life, we often reflect on some of the greatest things of the past, the greatest people, the greatest discoveries, the most important inventions, the best athletes, the best teams. We reflect on all of these things. We're always looking for things that are great, things that stand out, things that endure throughout time. And there's often a lot of different people, a lot of different things, a lot of different teams that come to our minds. If you think about some of the magazines that we look at that talk about some of the great people, some of the great events, we often we'll read People, we'll read Newsweek, we'll read Time, and it will have some of these things, some of these people mentioned specifically. Scott, this isn't working. I don't know exactly what. There we go. So we have these lists that are in our minds concerning great people, great things of the past. If we were to go back to the time that Elijah was alive, and we were to look at some of the events that he lived through, some of the things that he did, I wonder if Elijah would make some of these lists. Would People include Elijah in their magazine? Would Newsweek have a write-up about Elijah and the great things that he did? I don't see how what we're going to witness today could have been omitted from any such list. It's a classic fight to the finish between the pagan gods of the earth, the prophets of Baal, and the living God in the heavens. And it's a simply awesome battle that takes place, if you want to call it that. Imagine the headlines of the day, the battle of the gods, the greatest conflict of the century, the God who answers by fire. Today, if you ever have the opportunity to visit Israel, there is an oversized statue of Elijah that stands on a high pedestal at the peak of Mount Carmel. The bearded prophet stands with a large knife in his hand, raised high above his head. It's pictured right here. Below Elijah is an inscription that refers to this unforgettable conflict. For somewhere near the summit of this mountain, the prophet of God stood toe to toe with the prophets of Baal, calling down a dramatic, fiery proof of the one true and living God, who was and is worthy of worship and our obedience. Now, before we come to this moment, let's remember some of the events leading up to this. In 1 Kings 17, verse 1, we're first introduced to Elijah, the Tishbite. We remember that he was sent by God to go to King Ahab and to pronounce that it was not going to rain for a while. And that's exactly what Elijah did. From that moment, Elijah set himself up as a target. He was an enemy of the throne of Ahab. Then God told Elijah to withdraw from the spotlight and to go hide himself by the brook Cherith. Next, it was on to Zarephath, where Elijah was greeted by a desperate widow who was supposed to take care of him. And we know from last week that Elijah performed an unbelievable miracle through the hand of God when he brought the widow's son back to life. Now, in both places, when you look at Elijah when he was at Cherith and you see Elijah at Zarephath, he had to trust God completely for everything that he needed for life. He had to trust God for his food. He had to trust God for his water. And God never failed to provide for him. And he provided for Elijah in ways that he never could have imagined. I wonder if we've ever been in a situation where we have been completely dependent upon God. Now, all of us are there spiritually. When it comes to our salvation, we are 100% committed to God because we can't do anything ourselves. We cannot save ourselves. But physically, because of how blessed we are, and that's something that I notice when the men are praying for our offering each Sunday, One of the common thoughts that's expressed is how blessed we are as a nation, and it's true. And because we're so blessed, I don't know that we have felt this, where we are completely dependent physically on God for our food, for our water, because we trust in ourselves. We think we're providing all of these things for ourselves, for our families. Elijah was in a situation where he had to completely trust God. He had no other choice. Have you ever been there? Situation you're facing in life, there's no other alternative. There's no other option. There's nobody else to turn to. That's where Elijah was. That's where he was at Kereth. That's where he was at Zarephath. Well, after this, months passed, then years. And as the earth dried up day after day, Ahab's anger, it just continued to grow. He was the king. How many people were looking to Ahab for it? Ahab, why is this happening under your watch? He was furious with Elijah. How many moments did Ahab think back to that time when Elijah came before him and told him, hey, buddy, it's not going to rain for a while? How many times did Ahab think about that conversation as this drought just grew worse and worse, as the people became more and more desperate? We see the level of desperation within the life of the widow. That picture of her gathering sticks, going back to her home to cook one last meal before she and her son were going to, that was happening throughout this land. People were desperate. Finally, after 3 long years had passed, God is directing Elijah back to Ahab. And God has another message for the king. The encounter between Elijah and Ahab, it must have been something to see. Remember Elijah, he's the most wanted man in the land. And now God's telling him to go back to Ahab. You read through this story and you see that Ahab is hunting high and low for Elijah. He's got men going out all over the place, even outside of Israel, trying to locate where this guy is. And now God is asking Elijah, hey, just go knock on his door. Just go stand before him again in the king's court. Well, the search is now over for Ahab, because Elijah's on his way. And it happened after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the 3rd year. And this is what he said to Elijah. Go. Can you imagine what Elijah was thinking right there? If we just stop this statement right there. Because God has told Elijah to go to Kereth. He has told him to go to Zarephath. I'm sure Elijah's thinking, all right, where am I going now? What place am I going to go see? Who's going to take care of me? It's been the birds. It's been this widow. Who's going to provide for me now? Just the anticipation that Elijah must have felt when God said that word, go. Show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the face of the earth. Now, here is the moment God had been training Elijah for. What Elijah did at Kereth and what he did at Zarephath, when he was learning to trust God, it's all building up. It's like a fighter going through all of the training sessions, day after day, week after week, getting the body in shape. And then finally you enter the ring and it's game on. That's what's happening here. The training is over. It's time for Elijah to go and stand before Ahab once again. Now, what would this meeting be like? What will Ahab say to Elijah? What will Elijah say to Ahab? Well, this is what happened. Elijah went to show himself to Ahab, and the famine was severe in Samaria throughout this land. Everybody, they were feeling the effects of the drought. When Ahab saw Elijah, this is what he had been waiting for. This is why he had all of those men out trying to find him. Now he finally has his moment, and this is what he says. Is this you, you troubler of Israel? The noun form of the Hebrew verb that means to trouble, it means to bring calamity. That's what's translated here as troubler. Now, there are occasions when this Hebrew word is also used to mean viper or snake. You see what Ahab is saying? It's clear what he thinks of Elijah. To Ahab, this prophet of God, he's a snake. He's behind the trouble in the land. The famine was severe throughout Samaria. There was plenty of trouble, to be sure. And now Ahab confronts Elijah, and he basically says, "You snake, what have you done?" Try to imagine the scene. It's difficult for us. 3 years without a drop of rain in the entire land of Israel. Every brook has dried up just like at Cherith. When Elijah made his way from Zarephath to Ahab's palace, he must have walked across the carcasses and skeletons of many animals that were just dead because there was no water, there was no food, no vegetation. Just imagine what the stench of death must have been like in this land. Into the middle of this terrible scene walks this man who is being blamed for all of it, Elijah. Now, Elijah's gotten pretty good at taking blame. Remember when the widow's son died? The widow was like, "Elijah, you have caused this. Why have you brought this grief to me?" And now he's getting blamed for this horrible drought. So King Ahab, he meets the prophet with fire in his eyes, spitting out his condemnation. "You troubler of Israel, you snake." Took a lot of courage for Elijah to go to Ahab. Consider the faith, just the amount of trust that Elijah had to have in God to walk into this scene. He was told to go to Cherith. He was told that he was going to be fed by birds. The ravens were going to feed him. It took a lot of trust to actually go to Cherith and believe that God was going to do it. He was told to go to Zarephath and that a widow would take care of him, and he went. Now he is told to go stand before Ahab. To me, this is the most difficult assignment of all. But he was not intimidated. We don't see Elijah questioning God. Oftentimes in the Bible, even men of God, when they're asked to do difficult things, you see the backpedaling. "Uh-oh, God, what are you doing? You got the wrong person. Isn't that what Moses did? You want me to go stand before Pharaoh?" Don't think so. Same thing with Gideon. "Gideon, I need you to deliver my people who are being oppressed by Midian." I don't think so, Lord. But not Elijah. Even when he was told to go stand before King Ahab, after everything that's happened in the land, after this drought for 3 years, God tells him to go. And Elijah, based on the text, "All right, I'll pack my bags. I'm on my way." No hesitation, no questioning, no doubting. And then when he gets there, he had the audacity, he had the guts to shift the blame back where it belonged. When Ahab and Elijah stood together, there was indeed a troubler of Israel in the midst. But it wasn't Elijah. This is what Elijah said back to King Ahab. I love these dialogues in the Bible. Here you have the king of Israel talking to the prophet of God in the midst of a horrible situation. Ahab, he's going to throw Elijah under the bus. "You troubler of Israel, you snake." Well, this is what Elijah comes back with. "I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have." Remember all of the kings when we started this study? King after king after king after king, 60 years in Israel of bad kings. Each king being progressively worse, more evil than the one before it. Ahab being the most wicked of them all. Elijah's bringing that back up. "It's not about me. I'm not the problem here, Ahab, but you and your father's house. There's the trouble." Because you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and you have followed the Baals. I love how direct Elijah is. He'd probably get canceled in our culture today. But he just says it the way it is. It's not about me. You're the problem. Elijah not only stands before Ahab, he confronts him. He not only stands before the king. Keep in mind, this is a king, a man with power, a man with authority. He not only stands before him, he challenges him. Ahab, he's not used to that. Most people, they would just defer. And there had been too much deferring going on in Israel. Because even when it came to the worship of false gods, the people of Israel, they were just deferring to Ahab. But not Elijah. Don't blame me for what's happened. God brought this drought of judgment because of you. You're the reason we haven't had rain. You're the real troubler of Israel. You have forsaken God. You are worshiping idols. And Elijah didn't flinch. He didn't back down one inch. Hey, that could be in a Dr. Seuss's book. Elijah didn't flinch. He didn't back down one inch. He stood with God when in a pinch. And as a result, the prophets of Baal became drenched. Pretty good. Wait, almost forgot. Dr. Seuss has been canceled, so forget that. I tell you this, you can't cancel God. You cancel a lot of things in this world. You can't cancel God. And you can't cancel what Elijah did here. And now here's the challenge. This is where Elijah lays out this great fight that's going to take place. Now then, send and gather to me all Israel at Mount Carmel, together with 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of the Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. Elijah tells Ahab, hey, go assemble your people. Get your team. You have all of these prophets, all of these false gods. Get them together. Gather all of these men. I want to challenge all of them. Assemble your people and let's see what you've got. We can see how prominent these false gods were by the number of the idolatrous prophets that they had, as well as their exalted position in the kingdom. Look at the number. 450 prophets of Baal, 400 prophets of the Asherah. And where were they eating? They were eating at the queen's table. They were welcomed into the very court of the king. Ahab was eating with the enemy. Now think about all of the hurt, all of the pain, all of the desperation that was going on throughout the entire land of Israel, throughout all Samaria. And here you have Ahab feeding 850 people in the middle of a drought. This is a classic picture of how sin takes over a life. We let sin in and it just creeps in, and over time it just completely takes over. And before long, we're dining with the enemy. How would Ahab respond to Elijah's challenge? Elijah, he lays it on the line. Get your men. Well, this is what Ahab said. Ahab, he sent a message among all the sons of Israel, and he brought the prophets together at Mount Carmel. This is where the battle is going to happen. This is where the fight is going to take place. This is where Jehovah God is going to prove who he is in the midst of all of these false gods. It's getting good. The audience is gathered on Mount Carmel to witness the showdown. This is like the circle that forms when two middle school kids are about to fight. There are two groups pictured here. You have the prophets and the priests of the false gods, Baal and Asherah. And you also have the sons of Israel, which represented the general public. Do you see how far Israel has fallen away from God? Sometimes I think we miss this. In the middle of all of these wicked kings, in the middle of all of this evil and the idolatry and the immorality, these were the people of God. These were the people of the covenant. These were the descendants of Abraham. These were the people who were supposed to be set apart, the people who were supposed to live a life that was distinct. And this is what God was getting. This is what they were doing. After everything that God had done throughout the centuries prior, what he had done to deliver their ancestors time and time again, and this is the best they could do. You just look at Israel, and sometimes you think, do better. You got to do better than this. Is it any wonder why God became so infuriated with his people? We're not talking about some heathen nation. We're not talking about the Canaanites. We're not talking about the Hittites, the Jebusites. We're talking about the Israelites. These are God's people that are in the middle of all of this idolatry and immorality. And Elijah, he wants everybody there to witness what's about to happen. He wants the prophets of Baal there. Hey, make sure they're there. Ahab, go get them. Get all of them. I want them here. Go get the prophets of Asherah. I want them here. They've got to see what God is going to do. And even beyond that, I want the people of Israel here. I want God's people to see who really is all powerful. Then in verse 21, Elijah, he came near to the people. So you have the people gathered here. You got the prophets of Baal. You got the prophets of Asherah. They're up here on Mount Carmel. And this is what Elijah says to the people of Israel. How long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. But the people did not answer him a word. I love this statement that Elijah makes. It reminds me of what Joshua said way back in Joshua 24 to the nation of Israel. Well, Israel's hearing it again. How long will you hesitate between two opinions? You know, I've wondered that about many people through the years. Why do people hesitate? Why do people hesitate to commit to God? Why do people hesitate to step up into leadership roles? Why do people hesitate within their families to bring God into the center of their home? Why do we hesitate? Israel, they were hesitant because of all of these other false gods. And you know what? I think a lot of people today hesitate for the same reasons. The idols may have changed, but don't be deceived. There's still a lot of idolatry in our land. There's a lot of modern day idols that cause people to hesitate. Notice that the people of Israel have already moved into the hardcore camp of the Asherah and the Baals. Now you really have the battle lines drawn here. It's almost like the scene way back with David when he took on Goliath. You have the Philistines on one side, you got the Israelites on the other. It's what you have here, except this time the Israelites are on the wrong side. I want you to notice that Elijah lays out two choices. Isn't that really what it's all about? There's two choices. You can't stand in the middle. I love driving down Main Street to 48th, because right there at the corner of 48th and Main, there's a pasture with a bunch of cows in there. Bramer is what I used to call them. Some people call them Brahma. I just see those cows out there. Reminds me of when I grew up. Every time I go there, you know, you look at the cows out there. They got water. They got food. They seem content. There's a fence that goes around the entire property. You know, all the times that I've driven by there and all the times that I've seen cows out on a farm, whether it's where I grew up or other places, I've never seen a cow walking the fence. Because that's not a choice. A cow can't walk the fence. You're either on one side of the fence or you're on the other side of the fence. And that's how it is spiritually. And I think there's a lot of Christians that are trying to be trapeze artists. We want to walk the fence and we want to get on that tightrope and just say, all right, I'm on both sides. I'm right here in the middle. I've got God here. I've got the world here. And we think, wow, this is awesome. I'm doing both. Can't do both. The fence belongs to Satan. If you're on the fence, you've chosen. And that's what Elijah is laying out here to the people of Israel. Make your choice. There's two choices. There's not three. The fence isn't a choice. You're either on this side of the fence or you're on that side of the fence. Choose. Elijah, he confronts them with the truth. If you're only half-heartedly committed to God, you've made your choice. If you're content trying to walk the fence, you've made your choice. He says, how long will you hesitate? How long will you be lukewarm? How long will you vacillate? You can't have it both ways. If the Lord is God, then follow him. And I ask you, put it all to the test. Whatever idols you're struggling with, whatever it is that you're tempted to put above God, put everything to the test. Put your job, put your career, put your money, put your 401k, put your health, put your sports, put all of it to the test. And if money is God, if money is what can save you, if money is what can get you to heaven, then follow it. If fame can do that, then follow fame. Make that your God. If sports can do that for you, then by all means, worship at the altar of sports as often as you can. If Baal can do it, if Asherah can do it, whatever it is that can save your soul and take care of your eternal need, make that your God and follow it. And quit hesitating. Get on one side or the other. That's what Elijah is saying. It's decision time. But mom and dad, I urge you to think about this. You're doing more than choosing for you. You're also choosing for your kids. You're showing them who your God is. And the people didn't say a word. I think it was just like this, a silence. The people didn't say a word. They didn't answer Elijah's challenge. They didn't argue with him, because the easiest thing to do at the hour of decision, you know what the easiest thing to do is? To remain uncommitted. Just linger in the neutral zone. Be a pilot. And that's what they did. They were silent. But Elijah, he wasn't deterred. He stood there all alone, vastly outnumbered, 850 prophets versus one, all of the people of Israel on the other side versus him, but still knowing that he was invincible because he was in God's hands. Now do you see why God sent Elijah to Kerith? Now is it clear why God sent his prophet to Zarephath? He was getting him ready to stand before all of these false prophets and to stand before King Ahab and to stand before the entire nation of Israel and prove who God really is. Arrayed before Elijah, you had a lot of things going on. No doubt there were idol shrines erected here and there across the summit of Mount Carmel. Everybody brought their big head cut out of their favorite god. But Elijah, he wasn't afraid. He was God's man. And he was equipped with a plan that they could not ignore and one that they would never forget. And next week, we'll look at it. Tonight, why do you hesitate between two opinions? I can answer that question. I asked earlier, none of those other things can save you. Only God and his son can bring us salvation. Doesn't that make it clear who we should be committed to? If you need to make that decision now, we give you the opportunity as